So, we're just going to make our way through this half of chapter 20 in John's Gospel. And one of the really helpful things, if you're reading through John's Gospel, is to keep going back to the prologue. Keep going back, particularly to the first 18 verses of chapter 1. Because as John records the life of Jesus, he sets it in a context, actually, of the whole Bible. Because as I'm sure many of you would have recognized when we had our call to worship from John chapter 1, you immediately start to think, well, that sounds like Genesis. Well, that's deliberate. John wanted us to think back to the first, to the beginning. Because he now wants us to examine God, to think about God through the lens of the life of Jesus. And that's really what John is doing as he writes his gospel. And we see it even in this chapter 20, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark. So John is kind of setting the scene of the darkness in the world. He is simply describing that Mary, other gospels say there was a group of women, John just records Mary Magdalene, going to the tomb. He's describing it as it was still dark. It was early morning. But those that are familiar with John's gospel immediately start to think back to chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. While it was still dark, Mary goes to the tomb. And she sees that the stone has been removed. So she goes running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, which we assume is John. And she tells them. Essentially, she says to them, somebody's nicked the body. They've taken the Lord out of the tomb. I don't know where they've put him. Now, I find this next bit quite amusing. Because John, as he writes, describes him and Peter running for the tomb. They're both running. But the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. Why does he put in that little detail? You know, two of us were running, and I got there first. You know, we don't expect the gospel writers to have a little boasting moment, do we, about their energetic prowess in running. I find something hugely encouraging about the fact that John would write that. That he would actually make a point of saying, Peter and I, good wee run, I got there first. Why am I encouraged by that? Because it shows that he's human. He shows that he's just like the rest of us. And that comparing himself with someone else was a part of his life experience. Now, we might say, such a man thing to do, isn't it? You know, about the kind of, who got further on the treadmill? Or who got up the Monroe quickest? You know, something about that kind of physical. But us women, we do the comparison thing as well, don't we? You know, I make better scones than you. We just in the comparison game as human beings. It seems to me it's part of humanity. It's part of what we experience as human beings. And so it's a little detail in this passage that's about something that changes the world forever. But isn't it an interesting little detail? and that God has allowed it to be in his word. And there's something in that that I think is very deeply reassuring to us as human beings. So Peter runs in, goes straight into the tomb, sees the strips of linen lying there. And it's a different description to what John has described as Lazarus rising from the dead, where he had to be unwrapped from the linen strips that he'd been wrapped in and put in the tomb. This is different. This is of a different order of rising to life again. And I find it interesting that it says he saw and believed. You know, this is the other disciples. So this is John writing about himself. Finally, the other disciples reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. But they still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. So what did they believe at that point? Interesting question. What is it they believe? Maybe it is that, I mean, Jesus had said that he would return to the Father. So maybe that was what they believed. Oh, he's gone. You know, that's him away to the Father. If they weren't at this point actually believing the resurrection. But Mary stands outside the tomb crying. She is one who is expressing the grief that comes when a loved one dies. She is the one who is there confused, mystified, and she feels the need to stay close to where she thought Jesus was. And that's so true of grief, isn't it? Those of us that have experienced, and most of us probably have experienced the death of a loved one. Grief has many facets to it. And she is there, wondering, feeling the sadness, feeling the heaviness of what has happened. And you know, as we gather in church this morning, we may not have recently experienced a bereavement, but you know, when we listen to the news, there is a certain grief that can come over us just as we hear what is happening in the world. You know, we were at our World Assembly, and the atrocities within the Holy Land in Israel and in Gaza had just happened at the weekend of the week that we were gathering. And so our three colleagues from the Israeli Bible Society, the Palestinian Bible Society, and the Arab Israeli Bible Society couldn't be with us because of what was happening in their country. The Russian Bible Society weren't able to be with us because they couldn't get visas because of what's happening in Ukraine. The Syrian Bible Society couldn't be with us because of the conflict that continues in Syria. And then we had a few others where there was illness or other reasons that people couldn't gather. There is a term that is used at the moment to describe what you and I are absorbing when we listen to the news. And it's called polycrisis. It possibly started during the pandemic, where for many of us, our anxiety levels rose because of what was happening. We didn't really understand it. We didn't know how to control this virus. We went into lockdown. It was a traumatic experience for everybody. It was a great leveler across the world in some respects because it affected the whole world. But what is interesting is that my experience, and you have a think about how you feel and about the conversations you have with friends and with family, But my experience is that actually that anxiety level has not reduced with the opening up of things. Because actually, we hear of wars and rumors of wars. We experience painful things in our own families. So there's this level of personal and community, national and international crises that are happening. And because of technology, then it doesn't take very long at all before we hear of what's going on in different places. And so that anxiety is like a grief. And like Mary, we have to ask ourselves, what do we do with that grief? What do we do with that anxiety? She lingered. She lingered in the place where she expected to find the dead body of Jesus. She doesn't seem at all surprised by the two angels in white. I think that's an indication of the level of her grief. I mean, if I saw two angels in white, I think I would be a little bit taken aback. Don't you? You'd be a little bit surprised. But she shows no shock. And I think that is part of the depth of what she's feeling. So they ask her why she's crying. And she says, well, they've taken my Lord away and I don't know where they've put him. But she turns around and she sees Jesus, but she doesn't know it's Jesus. It's one of the mysteries of the resurrection as to why people didn't always recognize that it was Jesus. And he asks her the same question that the angels ask. Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for? Now, I find that interesting, that she replies to the question, why are you crying, whether it's by the angels asking her or by Jesus asking her, she replies with, where have you put him? But Jesus asks her, who are you looking for? And it's as if Mary is kind of, she's focused on the wrong thing. She wants to know the detail of where the body has gone. And Jesus wants to open her eyes to who is it you're looking for? And Jesus says to her, Mary. Oh, I just wonder how much meaning, purpose, affection, love was caught up in how Jesus says her name at this point. Because it's enough for Mary to recognize that it is Jesus who is saying her name. How do you hear Jesus say your name? What sort of tone of voice does he use when he speaks to you? The Bible is full of lots of different tones of voice. And it's a really helpful question whenever you're reading any bit of the Bible to ask, what tone of voice is being used here? But if we imagine Jesus speaking to Mary, the one who has come looking to minister to him in his death, bringing the spices to anoint his body. And Jesus speaks her name. There must have been tenderness. There must have been love. There must have been something of his accent that helped her to recognize. And she says, Rabboni, which means teacher. And then Jesus said, well, look, don't hold on to me because you know, we're in a kind of in-between time. I've not yet ascended to the Father. But go instead to my brothers. This is the first time in the gospel writings that the disciples are referred to as Jesus' brothers. Now no longer just followers of Jesus. Now no longer those that gather to hear his teaching and to learn from his miracles, but now declared as family, as brothers. Go and tell them, I'm ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and to your God. Go. And the wonder is that Mary is the first witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. At a time when women, their witness just wasn't counted. They weren't rated at all. So there's a wonder in Mary being asked to be the first witness. But I want, just as we draw this to a close, to also go back to not just John's prologue, but the prologue that sends us back to Genesis and the early chapters of Genesis, where again there is a man and a woman in a garden, Adam and Eve, who make some choices that distance themselves from the intimacy of relationship with the living God that they were made for. And now here we have a man and woman in a garden, and the man is going to restore that intimacy of relationship with God that humanity is designed for and made for. Mary is being sent from that garden in a very different way to how Adam and Eve were sent from the garden in Genesis. That was being sent out with some enmity and some pain, hard labor and death. But Mary is being sent out now to life and to a new community who are called the family of God, the children of God, the church of God. So friends, as we go into this week, do we go able to bring our grief, able to bring our concern about the world and about our own personal lives? But are we able to go looking not in the wrong directions, but in the right direction, looking to who? Who is it that helps us to live in this mixed up, confused, and broken world? Who is it that walks hand in hand with us as we go about life, whatever it holds for this week? Will we go hand in hand with Jesus? Will we share the Bible so that others will encounter Jesus? So I hope those few thoughts are encouraging, they're helpful, and we're going to express something of our response, because I hope even just dipping into a very familiar passage and a very familiar story has warmed our hearts, and we'll respond to that as we sing together, "How Deep the Father's Love for Us, for Each of Us." So if we're able, let's stand and sing together.